This is In Conversation from Apple News. I'm Shumita Basu. Today, navigating parenting in the digital age. Amanda Hess was pregnant with her first child when she went to her 7-month ultrasound appointment. And during the exam, the ultrasound tech noticed something unusual on the screen.
My son was sticking his tongue out, which I thought was so cute, and it is cute. But if it's happening persistently on an ultrasound, it can be a sign of a genetic condition.
In the moment, Amanda didn't know anything except that the technician looked concerned and left the room for what seemed like an eternity. And laying there on the exam table, Amanda had just one wish.
My feeling wasn't like, I wish my husband could be here. My feeling was, I wish I had my phone right now. I wish I had my phone in my hand so I could Google tongue sticking out ultrasound and understand what is happening.
It took weeks for Amanda and her husband to get a diagnosis, Beckwith Wiedemann syndrome, a growth disorder that affects about 1 out of every 15,000 births. In that period, while waiting for the diagnosis and figuring out what this might mean for the future of her baby, Amanda turned again and again to the internet. And even though Amanda is a culture critic at the New York Times who's been writing about the internet for years, she found it difficult to disentangle herself from everything she was reading.
I think I was a little bit naive about how sucked in I would get. I'm really used to just like dipping into some online community and trying to figure it out, writing about it, and then setting it down and moving on to the next thing. And I didn't realize this at the time, but once I became pregnant, there was no critical distance with my relationship with the internet.
Amanda wrote about this in a book called Second Life, Having a Child in the Digital Age. It's a deeply personal and thought-provoking memoir that explores how digital tools are reshaping everything from fertility and birth to parenting and identity. Amanda told me it was her period tracking app that started her down the rabbit hole.
You know, I used a pregnancy app called Flow, and every day it would give me new facts and tips, information about my pregnancy.
Your baby is the size of a grapefruit.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I had something similar, app.
When it says your baby, like, I didn't realize the extent to which I had internalized that, where, like, it really felt to me at a certain point like they were talking about my baby, when really they were talking about generic baby who might be born on the due date that you have put into this app. And, you know, it had no special insight into me or my child. But it really felt on this sub-rational level like it did.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Flow, the app, is almost referred to like a character in your book, right?
Yeah. I give Flow pronouns in the book, like she, her pronouns, because the app is just so feminized. And that's something that I thought was like pretty silly when I first started using it as a period tracker. And then when I engaged Pregnancy Mode, which is such a good name for what it is, Pregnancy Mode, I think I was not prepared for how much I would forget how silly it was and just start to like absorb its ideas about what a good pre-mother is and does.
Say a little more about that, because I think it's easy for people to imagine, if they haven't engaged with this app, that it's sort of like a gamification of your body or of your cycle, certainly. But what about it kind of crosses that boundary, or did for you?
Yeah, I mean, it is a gamification of pregnancy. That's such a perfect way of putting it. And that suggests that you could win pregnancy or you could lose pregnancy. And for me, I mean, one thing that it did was present this kind of like CGI cartoon figure of a stock pregnant woman, which was like a thin white woman with her head popped off, her head cut
the
off.
The ideal.
Yes, right. So she had no like personality. She was just thin white body. And you could see her bump, grow week by week. And this was supposed to be like a representation of what a pregnant body is, quote unquote, supposed to look like. When, of course, different pregnant bodies look very different.
Sure.
But also it was, you know, it was just this drumbeat of information. Like her recommended foods changed every week. Mm. There was like a new seed that she was recommending. And I didn't change my seed routine based on what I was reading, but I did absorb.
I don't even have a seed routine. Now I'm feeling very behind.
You know, I don't think I ate any seeds during my pregnancy, and that's maybe where things, you know. But the app really got me used to this idea that pregnant women were supposed to think about being pregnant all the time.
Mm.
And also I think it habituated me to this feeling of my body being surveilled by an outside authority, which is something that, especially in the United States, like as we're speaking right now, obviously goes far beyond period apps. But I do think just the daily habit of getting these tips, trying to understand if you're doing things moderately correctly, I think it gets people used to the idea that, like, they're not the authority. There's some shadowy authority out there that will be judging your performance in some way.
To measure yourself against somehow.
Yeah.
So in your seventh month, when you went to that ultrasound appointment and you ultimately learned that your baby had a genetic condition, how did that change your relationship to the app, for example, to Flo and what you were seeing, what you were being told your pregnancy looks like at that stage?
One of the most tantalizing things in Flo is this CGI representation of your fetus that changes week by week. And often it had this serene smile on its face, like its lips closed and smiling. And when I opened the app again after I had that ultrasound, where I realized that my son's tongue was sticking out in the womb, when I looked at this picture of the closed-lipped baby, I was like, for the first time, as absurd as this sounds, I was like, that's not my baby. That is a representation of a normal baby, which is a word that had never occurred to me to use in relationship to my pregnancy until then. It didn't occur to me to desire that. I just kind of assumed, and I felt, based on this intimate relationship with this app that was in my hand, that that was fairly literal representation of my baby, as if it could see inside my womb. And it was only after I realized that my child did not look like that image that I could understand how the app was promoting this idea of normalcy, which is false, to start to understand that, like, disability is a variation on normal, but it's not one that we see in these, you know, really mainstream places. Flo is an app that's used by hundreds of millions of people around the world, and that has facilitated like tens of millions of pregnancies. And so it's supposed to be made to apply to everyone, even as it appears to be intimate and personal. And of course, it's not personal.
You know, in your book, you talk about some of the darker histories you uncovered in some of the devices and the apps that you used and how they relate to what you're saying about, quote unquote, normal pregnancies and children. Can you tell me a little bit about what you found when you started digging into Flo specifically?
Yeah. When I started to write about Flo, I became interested in like the history of menstrual tracking, and I was interested in when people started to do this, who was sort of developing this tracking, when it became a commercial idea. And I found this woman, a British scientist named Marie Stopes, who had created something that she called rhythm charts that tracked her menstrual cycle on graphs and pinpointed how she felt over the course of that cycle, specifically like when she was interested in having sex. And she felt like there were like two periods in a month where her sex drive was the highest. And I was really interested in her because she had translated this physical thing into data. And she did this for a political cause, which was really to normalize women's sexual desire. And I found that to be so interesting and inspiring, really. And then I found out that she was also very interested in eugenics, which should not have been surprising to me, because a lot of people in her era, just like a lot of people in our era, were. But really, like, scratching beneath the surface of any birth technology, you will find histories of people who are trying to optimize birth in order to improve the general human population. Mm. And I think in the early 1900s, when Marie Stopes was doing her rhythm charts, she was very overt about that, saying that she was interested in increasing basically like sexual relations and then births among upper and middle class, white, educated, able-bodied people, and to discourage births among, you know, people that she saw as less than. So, you know, I think she called them the poor and diseased. That language isn't popping up typically in a modern pregnancy app, but you can see the way that an image of the ideal pregnant person continues to be furthered there. And I think there's a thin line between technologies that try to make life better for babies and children and families, and technologies that want to build better babies.
That's really fascinating. You know, you write in the book that what ended up being most helpful for you was finally getting to meet your son and just seeing him and observing him and learning to parent him, who he is. But during that period when you say you were really looking for information about this diagnosis of Beckwith Wiedemann syndrome, or BWS, looking back, what actually helped you at that time, and what was maybe not so helpful?
So at that ultrasound, my doctor told me that he saw something he didn't like, which I think is a term that I've since heard that other doctors use, and I hated that term. Mm-hmm. Like, he looked at my baby and he saw something he didn't like. Get out of here. Mm-hmm. I wanted to, like, prove him wrong. I think I wanted to assume that authority over the pregnancy that I felt like I had lost. And I also wanted to understand if I could blame myself. Mm-hmm. So I was searching, like, all of the cardinal features that had been mentioned to me in the analysis of the ultrasound and everything that I had done that was less than optimal during the pregnancy. So an anti-anxiety medication that I took early in pregnancy, the wine that I drank early in pregnancy before I knew that I was pregnant, the hot bath that I took after I knew that I was pregnant, and I just forgot that that can be dangerous. So I was searching, like, hot bath, whatever, whatever. And that was not helpful for me. I think one of the worst things that I found when I was searching, beyond these medical possibilities, when I searched BWS, what I found was tabloid coverage of children who have it. So a story in the Daily Mail about, you know, the Daily Mail headlines use, like, all caps when they want to emphasize something. So it would be, like, toddler born with extra large tongue or something, like, has pediatric cancer and is, like, fighting to whatever, with pictures of the child, like, in medical settings. So I think that also influenced how I thought about who my son might be and what his life might be like. Mm-hmm. The thing that was ultimately helpful for me was when my son actually got his diagnosis, when I was around 8 months pregnant, and I was able to join groups, Facebook groups, for people who have BWS and their families, and virtually meet thousands of people who have this thing and see, you know, the diversity and beauty of their lives. And then I also found influencers on TikTok who were talking about their kids who had BWS, which I really liked, because if you have a kid who has a rare syndrome, like, you're probably not going to see a kid who looks like them in, like, a Baby Gap commercial. Mm-hmm. But on TikTok, there are so many people on there that, like, you probably will find someone whose kid has that. But then I read the comments and saw so many people saying things like that they shouldn't have been born, that they find it disgusting. Like, why am I seeing this? Stuff like that. And so I think what I absorbed from that deep Googling experience was my son has something that is stigmatized, and that's something that, like, I need to resolve before he arrives. But it really wasn't until he got there that I was able to do that.
Yeah, yeah. Let's stay with these sort of influencer accounts on social media for a moment, because I really think this is where so much parenting advice comes from nowadays. And I do think there's a sort of disparaging way that a lot of people think about these accounts, which is interesting to me. I mean, the way that I look at it is, how different is it from the way that people would pick up a parenting book from a bookstore at a certain point? I mean, maybe people still do that sometimes, but not as much. Mm. Or picking up a phone and calling 2-3 friends who've been through it already. Oh my God, I don't know what to do. He won't go to sleep. What did you do when you were faced with this? To me, it feels like a turbocharged version of that, right? Like turning to your village.
Yeah.
But in a different way. It's not exactly the same. It exists in a third way. I mean, how do you see these things fitting together? The new media that is parenting influencers online.
I mean, Americans love parenting advice, and they have for many decades and perhaps centuries. And a lot of the advice, you can find, like, old parenting advice that seems absurd and ridiculous now. But when I got a 1940s copy of Benjamin Spock's book, I found that, like, a lot of his advice was pretty similar to something that you might see on, you know, a modern gentle parenting account. Mm-hmm. What was different was, you know, he was very much of his own time. So he was a male pediatrician who was essentially talking down to women exclusively, because it was assumed that, like, the mother would be, like, the person who is in charge of disciplining the child. He called his reader the tired out mother, which, like, that is what I am.
not true.
Right. But I think now the thing that's very much of our time is the tired out mother being the expert herself and sort of performing this kind of burlesque version of, like, raising children, you know, with sort of viral trending jokes while also dispensing the advice. And so she's, like, simultaneously the expert and the common person. Hmm. And I think one thing that does is tell people that the way to be a good parent is not just to follow the advice, but for you to be an expert as well. That would be the most advanced thing you could do. And so I think there is a way in which parents are expected to mold themselves in the style of an expert. But I also think you gave this example of, like, calling up your friend and asking what to do when you can't get your baby to sleep. And the thing about that is it bonds your families together, you know? Mm-hmm. It's like that's a person that you're talking to. Whereas with a lot of these influencer accounts, it's a person who is talking to you, but who doesn't know you and has no real interest in your family, because they're speaking to, like, millions of followers in some cases. And I think it's just like anything with the development of capitalism, it's just the pace is increasing. Just this idea that every time you look at your phone, you will get more advice about your kid, whether you're really looking at that or not. And I think, again, like, what the drumbeat suggests is that our children and their emotions can be controlled and managed and optimized in this way if you just, like, absorb enough of the advice and you implement enough of the tips. Mm. And I think the sad thing to me about parenting influencers, especially, you know, so many of them call themselves our digital village, is just, like, I live in New York, and so there are so many parents who are living in their isolated apartments, probably looking at these accounts, when if our society was structured in a way that was actually interested in raising all children better, we would just have so many more communal resources that we could share between each other, as opposed to between us and an influencer who's trying to sell us something.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think this is what I always struggle with when I go online and I'm searching around and I come across lots of parenting advice. I mean, first of all, it was so immediate when I had my baby. I remember thinking like, wow, my Instagram looks completely different.
Mm-hmm.
It knows I've had a baby. It knows I'm in the newborn black hole. But I also got the sense, and this was the icky feeling, it knows that I'm vulnerable.
Yes.
Was a feeling that I remember having.
Mm-hmm.
Because I felt really hawked. I felt like products were being pushed at me to solve X problem or Y problem. And the implication, and it wasn't always a subtle one, but the implication was always, you're going to mess up your baby if you don't buy this thing, right?
Yeah. I think there's this fantasy that is maybe most acute in pregnancy, but then in the newborn stage, that your child is so moldable that every single choice that you make has profound implications for the rest of their life. And I think the thing that felt ickiest to me was like in the newborn stage, you are in, or at least I was, like complete survival mode.
Mm-hmm.
Like I'm literally trying to keep him and myself, my husband, alive. We're just trying to survive this. And so later, I think, you know, I started to see some stuff that was about like, you know, the specific way that you should speak to your baby when you're like changing his diaper or something that I like had never done. Like I was just trying to get mm-hmm. the diaper to stick in the way that it's supposed to. And I think even though the rational part of me is like, that's nonsense and they're trying to take advantage of you, there is a part of me that absorbs that message that you can or you could and you should do more. And I think the thing that's so insidious about my internet use was that I was taking all the parts of me that I'm ashamed of and just feeding them into the internet instead of like talking to my friends about it.
Hmm. Was there any behavior switch that you made in the moment that you could see was not helping you and you decided to act differently?
For me, like the thing that really changed how I see all of these kind of like surveillance and monitoring apps is I installed a smart camera in my kids' room and I did it to understand how it worked, to write about it for the book, because I had used a video monitor that is caveman-like compared to these. And I set it up and I watched my children's cute and beautiful movements for a few weeks. And then eventually one night I laid down with my older son on his bed to give him a back rub as he was trying to go to sleep. And I saw these four glowing dots in the corner of the room that I realized were coming from the camera. And it wasn't until then that I understood that, like, I see this very cute, adorable vision of the kids through the camera, and they see four evil eyes, basically. And that's their experience. Like, they don't see some idealized image of their mother or whatever.
They don't see you adoring them back.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I also wonder what it means for children to grow up with this conflation of surveillance and care that's so intimately, you know, installed in their rooms and in some cases with these gadgets like on their bodies. Even now, you know, like so much of my care of my kids and my attention to them is connected to my phone where I want pictures and videos of them, and I'm always thinking about how they're growing up and I'll never get to see this version of them again unless I take a video of it. And this happens in their daycare setting too. There's like an app that their caretakers can take photos of them, and it like gives me a few pictures during the day so I can feel as if I'm with them when in fact like I'm recording this podcast
right.
with you.
Right. Uh-huh.
And I wonder what that's like from their perspective, to have a device put in their face by the people who are closest to them, who care for them, and to feel like that is what it means to have someone pay attention to you and care for you.
Mm. Yeah, I liked one of the conclusions toward the end of the book, but I wanted to ask you about it because you wrote, "There was such a thing as a good parent, I decided, one defined not by how much they invested in their own kids, but how much they're invested in everyone else's." Can you tell me why that feels like your takeaway?
I think for me, I spent so much of the early years of my kids' life like intensely focused on our own family. And some of that was so necessary because my child did have these complex medical needs, and it meant that we were spending more time going to a hospital in a different state or taking him to checkups or getting a couple of surgeries. But what I came to understand is I like finally started to stagger out of the early childhood period was that like the thing that my son is really missing and that I cannot buy is like a functioning society. Mm-hmm. Like I can't buy him a community. And so the way to get your child a community is to start thinking about other kids. One of the things I'm most ashamed about after having become a parent is that I was not more helpful to families before I became a parent when I had all of this time.
And I hear this from so many people.
And I had some extra money.
That's
gone now, too.
Right.
Yeah. And, you know, I've like apologized to some of my friends who had kids before I did, where I was just like, oh, here's a onesie. Like, congratulations. You know, I just wasn't, I didn't realize what a profound and difficult experience it was. So, I mean, for me, the greatest tech community that I'm a part of is just like WhatsApp groups for mutual aid in my neighborhood. And they're so great because you still get the dopamine hit of like getting constant messages, and you still get connected with like other families in your community. It's just the basis of that connection is not fear or self-blame or commerce. It's about connecting the resources in the community with its immediate needs. And that's something that I think, especially because of how housebound I am with little kids, that I only would have discovered and have been able to become a part of online.
Mm-hmm. Amanda, thank you so much for your time. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
You can find Amanda Hess's memoir, Second Life, Having a Child in the Digital Age, on Apple Books. We'll include a link to it on our show notes page.